Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And Leo.
And tonight we're going to bring you some alternative news as well as an interview that we did last night with, is it Dan Wolf?
Dan Wolf, yeah.
Dan Wolf is his name. And he was an excellent person to interview. He's a very creative guy who actually crafted a bill to go before Congress so that people who are tyrannized by rogue political regimes can sue. And he actually did that for people who were held as human shields during the first Iraq War. And he's a lawyer, and he represented them. And they collected money from that regime, from Saddam Hussein, from the assets that were frozen here before we entered the second war with Iraq. And he collected millions of dollars for people who were held as human shields. And because he was the lawyer who represented them, he got a significant amount of money.
Right.
And with that money, he took half of it, and he founded a nonprofit called, let me just make sure I have it correct, International Lifeline Fund, and he helps people in Africa have better life. And one of the ways he does that is by drilling wells and also by helping people purchase a stove. I mean, it sounds really strange that he helps people purchase a stove. But it turned out to be a lifeline. It's called the Magic Stove, and it's a simple, fuel-efficient clay stove, and it has the potential to transform the living and working habits of the people of Africa. And he explains it much better than I am right now. And that's about a half-hour interview.
Yeah.
And that'll be on at 8:30. And it's really worth listening to. He's a wonderful person. I mean, his big heart comes through in the interview and his integrity. So I urge you to stay tuned for that. It's really...
Yeah, it's fascinating people that we've been able to interview over the years.
I could feel his warmth right through the phone line. He's just a really great guy and a really caring person. But in the meantime, we have some news.
Yeah.
To bring you.
I thought we'd start with here.
Well, you'll have to read that one, Leo, because the print is very small. I can't read some of these things because the print's too small.
You might want to read this one just for the people that might be interested. We read this last night, but, you know, since that show doesn't get fully recorded, and I'm thinking that we may wind up, what we may do is just play the two-hour Wednesday night show, which will be the Tuesday night program, since it's not archived anywhere else, and we'll just do that.
Play the whole show? Do you have that?
Oh, well, no, not tonight. I don't have it.
In the future?
Right.
This is from Press TV.
Yeah.
And Silicon Alley Insider. Obama, we need to bail out newspapers or blogs will run the world. This is by Yael Biziuati and John Carney, September 21st. Obama yesterday expressed concern at the sorry state of the news industry and said that he will look at a newspaper bailout because otherwise blogs will take over the world and that would be a threat to democracy. I am concerned that if the direction of the news is all biosphere, all opinions with no serious fact-checking, no serious attempts to put stories in context, that what you will end up getting is people shouting at each other across the void, but not a lot of mutual understanding, he said. He said that he would be happy to look at bills that could give tax newspapers tax breaks if they were to restructure as 501c3 educational corporations. One of the bills is that of Senator Ben Cardin, who has introduced the Newspaper Revitalization Act. This strikes us as the worst kind of protect-the-horse-and-buggy policy imaginable. Newspapers have been printing money for 100-plus years, and if the market is now putting an end to that, stifling this change probably isn't a good idea. Back in May, we came up with 10 one-line reasons this kind of bailout is a terrible idea. Briefly, they were. Number one, it's bad to reward outdated businesses based on outdated technology. Number two, newspaper delivery trucks don't run on water. Number three, traditionally bloated monopolies, newspapers don't know how to innovate. Next, just because newspapers go away doesn't mean sources will. Newspapers employ just 0.2% of the nation's labor force. 65% of the people get their news from TV. Newspaper owners think Google is a parasite. Ask people when they last bought a paper, much less subscribed. A government-subsidized free press isn't a free press at all. As newspapers go away, a shrinking supply of ad inventory will drive up ad prices, rewarding innovative news media. So there, those are the reasons why you shouldn't bail out the press.
Yeah.
If the presses go cold, they should.
Yeah, it's kind of like that's capitalism.
And their day is gone.
And the Obama socialism is not a good idea. You know, bailing out dinosaurs is like
that's regressive.
Yeah.
It was like bailing out the car places. That was regressive too.
Yeah, and the problem is it's not going to last. You know, eventually
banks.
Or banks, yeah, banks, definitely banks. You know,
those that can't make it are going to die anyway.
Yeah, because they've made bad decisions.
They continue to make bad decisions.
They got bad CEOs, and like any other place that makes bad deals, they go under. And, you know, that's the market, guy. I mean, I've had businesses that have had to fall because they couldn't bear, you know, it just couldn't contain its...
To put it simply, folks,
it happens.
You plant a seed in poor soil, it ain't gonna grow.
That's right. Or if it stops, or even if it's in good soil, if it stops raining, you know, for a year, all right, it's going to dry up.
You're gonna die.
And that's basically what happens. I mean, if you don't have customers for a year, no matter how good your business is or was, the market changes, or you're selling widgets and nobody wants them, everybody's buying digits, you know, you're gonna lose.
Yeah,
so that's
when people rode horses and the car was invented. People stopped buying horses.
Yeah, except for leisure, and that was like, you know, the end of the horse trade business.
That's right. You got to go into something else.
Yeah.
That's just how it is. Time marches on, and you better change with it. And bailing out all these dinosaurs isn't going to make it any better.
No, and the dinosaurs of industry that have held back, actually technology, improvements in technology for years. General Motors, Big Oil, all these have bought out competitors and bought out small companies, innovative companies, and frozen their
and
technology.
And suppressed their creativity and technology.
That's right. And they're doing it everywhere. Cures for cancer have been, repressed, bought out by Big Pharma, and, you know, hell, they're making too much money if they on cancer. If they cured cancer, what would happen, you know? They'd be out of business. And then they'd have to create diseases, which is like the H1N1 virus.
That.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, it's pretty sick business. Let's see. A nation on mind-altering drugs, antidepressants, most commonly prescribed drugs in the U.S.,
Mm.
Shall I read that?
Yep.
As Natural News has reported in detail.
And I like this website, Nancy.
Yeah, Natural News is pretty accurate. Naturalnews.com. Antidepressants like Prozac, which is fluoxetine, and the growing list of similar selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor drugs not only can have numerous side effects from nausea to headaches, but they also have been linked to horrendous problems, including suicides in teens and sudden death in women, and even murders. But has that stopped U.S. doctors from prescribing the drugs or slowed down the antidepressant pill popping by Americans? Well, apparently not. New research shows that antidepressants are now the most widely prescribed drugs in the country. And according to a report in the August issue of Archives of General Psychiatry, a journal of American Medical Association, there have been a dramatic increase in the use of antidepressants since 1996.
Since they started advertising them on TV.
Yeah, right. It's not only stressed out middle-aged folks being treated by problems caused by supposed depression. Either, perhaps the most disturbing part of the new study is that it shows a broad expansion in the patient population being put on these drugs, starting with children as young as six. Several factors may have contributed to this trend, including a broadening in concepts of need for mental health treatment and campaigns to promote mental health care and growing public acceptance of mental health treatments, the researchers state in their article. To come up with a new antidepressant statistic, Mark Olfason, MD, Columbia University Medical Center, New York Psychiatric Institute, and Stephen Marcus, PhD of the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, studied data from 1996 to 2005. Medical expenditure panel survey sponsored by the agency for healthcare research and quality to estimate U.S. healthcare usage and costs. In all, 18,993 people from age 6 and older were included in the 1996 survey, and 28,440, this gets so technical, I should have edited this out, covered information regarding medical visits, prescriptions, and all that crap. And all the researchers found that the rate of antidepressant treatment increased from 5.84% to 10.12% between 96 and 2000. It's not that substantial. And that
double,
but only 10%, and that translated in a remarkable increase from an estimated 13.3 million taking depressants to 27 million. Well, if you put it in terms of the number of people, now on the mind and body altering drugs, 27 million Americans on mind altering drugs. Yeah, and they're concerned about pot and alcohol and illegal drugs. Curious. The only people who aren't apparently being prescribed these medications and drugs are those in racial and ethnic minorities, possibly because they may be less likely to afford the expensive drugs.
Probably don't have health insurance.
Or insurance copays. Exactly.
You can't have the drug. You don't have copays.
You don't have any money, so you got to be crazy.
Yeah. So,
significant.
So you're saying.
So significant increases in antidepressant use were evident across all sociodemographic groups examined, except African Americans, who had comparatively low rates of use in both years. And it isn't only antidepressant usage that is soaring. The report found that among the millions of Americans taking those drugs, huge numbers of them are now being prescribed antipsychotic medications. The percentage who were also prescribed antipsychotic medications increased between 96 and 2005 from 5.46 to 8.86%. Would common sense dictate that people who are so mentally ill that they need to be put on strong antipsychotic medication should be getting psychotherapy help too? Well, the new study shows that isn't the case. In fact, there hasn't been an enormous drop in the number of people undergoing psychotherapy. A decrease from 31.5% to 19.87% in recent years. Together with an increase in the number of antidepressant prescriptions per antidepressant user, an average of 5.6 versus 6.93 per year, these broad trends suggest that antidepressant treatment is occurring within a clinical context that places greater emphasis on pharmacologic rather than psychologic dimensions of care, the author wrote. In simple terms, too many doctors are handing out prescriptions for powerful drugs that affect the mind and entire body, supposedly because of mental or emotional illness, without any attempt to see if counseling or therapy might be a safer and more sane approach. Isn't that amazing?
I'm not surprised.
You wonder why there's so many crazy things going on, man. It's like 27 million Americans are on antipsychotic drugs.
Whoa.
Yeah.
No, they're on antidepressants, and then some are on antidepressants.
Well, they're all getting bumped up to antipsychotic drugs.
Scary.
Yeah, well, so you wonder if the guy at work is just looks like he's out of his mind, or maybe he's on some serious drugs. So, anyway, you know, it's all legal, folks. Let's see. Paralyzed cancer drug girl to be put on at-risk register to shut her up. Now, this is Mail Online. This is from Britain. I mean, they do really weird crap over there.
They sure do in that country.
Yeah, in that country, boy, in England, they really screw around with the people. A mother was planning legal action against the pharmaceutical giant, claiming her daughter was left partially paralyzed after having an anti-cancer vaccine, has been told the teenager is to be put on the social services at-risk register. Cheryl Cave says allegation that she is abusing her 13-year-old daughter, Ashley, are an attempt to shut her up as she is demanding an investigation into the safety of a drug used to protect girls against the HPV virus that causes cervical cancer. Ashley collapsed shortly after being given the jab, they call it, at school, and has spent nearly a year in the hospital. Ms. Cave, 38, is now consulting lawyers about taking action against pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline and wants a full investigation into the safety of the drug Cervarix. She is being supported by lawyer Peter Todd, who is launching a multi-million pound action on behalf of about 10 teenage girls in the UK, including Ashley. Ashley from Liverpool has been unable to walk unaided since having the jab last October and is an inpatient at Liverpool's Adler Hay Hospital. Tests have failed to find anything physically wrong. Doctors say Ashley is suffering from learned illness behavior and have called in social services. A report from Shefton Council accuses Ms. Cave of fabricating Ashley's illness and says Children's Services recommend that Ashley becomes subject to a child protective plan under the criteria of emotional harm. But Ms. Cave said it is nothing more than an attempt to keep her quiet and is desperate to warn other parents about the vaccine. She said, at first they tried to tell us Ashley was imagining it. They even suggested I have Munchausen's syndrome by proxy and have now told me Ashley is to be placed on the at-risk register and that I am abusing her mentally. I refuse to let their threat silence me. Ms. Cave believes her daughter may have been poisoned by aluminum in the drug. An HPV school vaccination program followed clinical trials in 2005 on more than 18,000 women under the age of 26. Last night, both GlaxoSmithKline and the Department of Health said there was no evidence that the vaccine carried any long-term side effects. No one was available at Sefton Council to comment on the case.
Huh.
So,
scary.
The girl was in the hospital for a year, paralyzed
she's
for a year.
She's still in the hospital.
Yeah, she's in and out of that, and she's in
poor
a wheelchair.
Girl. She's only a kid,
yeah,
13.
And there were 1,300 people, and they didn't mention in this article, but on all those trials that they did,
yeah,
there were 1,300 of them that came down with the same problems or different problems.
Different degrees of that problem.
Right.
Paralysis.
Yeah. And it's mercury and aluminum and all this other crap they're throwing into these vaccines. I mean, you know, it's just horrible what they're doing to people with these vaccinations. So.
Well,
you know,
I have something from Mercola.com. Despite anti-vitamin D bias, CDC stumbles on deficiency linked to H1N1 deaths. So far, swine flu H1N1 has killed 36 children in the U.S. An analysis of CDC data indicates vitamin D deficient children at higher risk of death. The CDC, that's the Center for Disease Control, did not realize they discovered this. However, anyone familiar with vitamin D literature will recognize it. Almost two-thirds of the dead children had epilepsy, cerebral palsy, or other neurodevelopmental conditions like mental retardation. All of these neurological conditions associated with childhood vitamin D deficiency exacerbating the problems further. Many of these kids take anticonvulsant drugs, which lower vitamin D levels. 58 million American children are vitamin D deficient. 7.6 million are severely deficient. When researchers looked at more than 6,000 American kids aged 1 to 21 who were carefully selected to be representative of the average American child, 9% of these kids had 25 OHD levels, less than 15 ng/mL, and 70% had levels, I guess, they were deficient in vitamin D. Those numbers don't mean anything to me, and I'm sure they don't mean anything to you, except people in the know. As the advent of the experimental swine flu vaccination program draws near, I want to highlight the information coming out that confirms the importance of having sufficient vitamin D levels in order to limit your chances of contracting swine flu or any other influenza, for that matter. Dr. Cannell, who is a leader in the field of vitamin D research and education, points out that CDC unwillingly supports the theory that your vitamin D levels likely play an equally important role in the swine flu as in other types of seasonal flu. According to the CDC statistics, H1N1 flu has killed 36 children in the U.S., and of these, almost two-thirds had either epilepsy, cerebral palsy, or some other neurological developmental condition like mental retardation. All of these neurological conditions are associated with childhood vitamin D deficiency. Previously, this is according to Dr. Cannell, he observes this. Previously, Dr. Cannell has published a very credible hypothesis that explains the seasonal nature of flu. His findings were first published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Infection 2 years ago. His hypothesis was confirmed by another study, the largest and most nationally representative of its kind to date, that involved 19,000 Americans. It too found that people with the lowest blood vitamin D levels reported having significantly more recent colds or cases of the flu. So that's an important thing. And I want to just add down here, at least four of the recent studies show this relationship, that the higher your vitamin D level, the lower your risk of contracting colds, flu, and other respiratory infections. Let's see. A 2007 study suggests the higher vitamin D status enhances your immunity to microbial infection. They found that subjects with vitamin D deficiency had significantly more days of absence from work due to respiratory infection than did control subjects. A 2009 study on vitamin D deficiency in newborns with acute lower respiratory infection confirmed a strong positive correlation between newborns and mothers' vitamin D levels. Over 87% of all newborns and over 67% of all mothers had vitamin D levels lower than 20 ng/mL, which is a severe deficient state. So there are a number of studies here. What else do they say? Most American children and teenagers are vitamin D deficient. Canada leads the pack, studying the vitamin D's impact on the swine flu. So they're ahead of everybody on that. Found out even more important information about vitamin D. I strongly recommend you watch a one-hour free vitamin D lecture along with the video on vitamin D's role in flu prevention. So if you go to, this site, which is Mercola.com, you'll be able to find that video and if you're interested in pursuing things a little more.
Yeah. And we're going to do our interview in just a few minutes. I just want to bring up, I just want to give you some info on Dan Wolf.
It's probably on the tape.
No, it's not.
I read that.
I know it is, but I had to.
Oh, you had to.
Yeah, the tape wasn't loud enough. But, Upon graduating from Michigan Law School in 86, Wolf served for 2 years as an attorney at the United States Department, State Department. Oh, that's how he got to know all this good stuff. In 20 years since that time, he has been a lawyer in private practice in Washington, D.C. And during the last decade, his practice has focused on the prosecution of class action lawsuits in which he has fought to protect the rights of consumers, employees, and victims of human rights abuses.
He's only 48.
Yeah.
So he did a lot when he was probably in his 30s.
Yeah, I think it's 46, 48, yeah. Mr. Wolf was co-founder and general counsel of LAVAS, an organization that advocates for the and provides free legal assistance to Vietnamese boat people in Southeast Asia in the 90s. From 1989 to 2005, Mr. Wolf also served as a volunteer consultant for Refugee International, for whom he has participated in missions to various war-torn regions, including Kosovo, Liberia, and Darfur. In 2004, Mr. Wolf founded the International Lifeline Foundation, a fund, nonprofit humanitarian organization, for which he serves as executive director. And for the past 3 years, Lifeline has been operating clean water and sustainable technology programs in East Africa. And Dan Wolf doesn't just inspire, he affirms with his intelligence, authenticity, generosity, and compassion. And this is that's the interview we have tonight with
Dan
Wolf.
And I say hear, hear for that, because I think that's very true. He was great.
And just so you know, he's giving a, they mentioned it in the speech, but.
I think you'll find him very interesting, and I know I did.
And Dan Wolf bit the beast. Saddam Hussein dared to sue Saddam Hussein and won $95 million, then flipped his new fortune to save millions of lives in Africa. So I hope you enjoy the interview. It starts off a little rough. It cut off about the first minute or so of it, but the bulk of the thing is there, and you get the gist of it. So we hope you enjoy it, and we're going to start now.
Environmental degradation through programs and activities that generate the greatest possible impact at the least possible cost. So we look for interventions that can truly make a difference at the most basic levels, and they can show people that, in fact, you know, their money can go a long way in relieving the devastation that Africa has been suffering for many years, and which has only gotten worse.
I know. I read a little bit about one of your Lifeline projects is the Magic Stove.
Sure.
And I thought that was very interesting, and it was just amazing that the difference that this small stove makes in the lives of the people that are lucky enough to have one, and also what it does for the area in which they live in Africa. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I would be happy to. So basically, it is astonishing what a difference a stove can make. I mean, obviously, when people think about ways of intervening in Africa and other parts of the developing world, probably one of the last things that comes to mind is, well, what can we do to change the way people cook?
Yeah.
But it is probably one of the two or three, in my opinion anyway, one of the two or three most important interventions that can have the greatest impact. That is because cooking is at the center of life in Africa, as it is in many other parts of the world. And the process of cooking involves, if you don't have a stove, if you don't have a gas range or an electric range, and you're living essentially a very primitive life, the method of cooking is to use three stones and a lot of wood. And much time and effort is obviously spent collecting that wood and cooking on an open fire, which in turn creates a myriad of problems, the livelihood problems that are associated with the collection, because you literally will spend several hours a day collecting and cooking, because it's not the most efficient method of cooking, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it creates huge health problems. The breathing in of indoor air pollutants, of toxic fumes from these open fires, is extremely hazardous to human health. And if you ever go inside a hut in an African village, you'll see what I mean, because you'll be able to stand there for maybe 30 or 40 seconds before or you have to leave because your eyes are going to start watering, you're going to start coughing, and you'll find it unbearable. And yet these women are spending hours on end cooking and breathing in these terrible fumes, and it's obviously that creates a huge health problem for them. There's also a safety hazard for children, young babies, who and young kids who fall into that open fire. You'll see a lot of burn victims. There is a security hazard, which is in places like Darfur and places like the Somali border of Kenya, when people have to go out long distances to collect wood in an unstable environment. They expose themselves, women expose themselves to rape and other forms of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, really, in many ways above all, one of the major problems with cooking on an open fire is it depletes the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in the areas that we're working, which include northern Uganda and Darfur and the Kenyan border of the Somali border of Kenya, those areas have lost one-third of their forest cover in the last 20 years. And this is a fact that in 40 years, these regions, pretty much most of Africa, will lose its entire forest cover, and there'll be nothing left. Africa will look like Haiti, which, if your listeners are aware of the situation in Haiti, Haiti is basically a barren wasteland. And when that happens, we're going to see disasters unfold of practically biblical proportion.
Now, you stated that you've produced about 50,000 of these since 2006. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's correct. In Darfur, in Uganda,
right.
Kenya, along the Somali border, and in Tanzania, along the Burundi's border.
Yeah, and another thing was the clean water program that you instituted. Now that's got to be a tremendous help there.
Yeah, well, that's huge. Clean water, something that we take for granted in this country. Obviously, we assume that water is clean or close to clean and drinkable. We can get it right from our faucet. If not, we can buy a bottle of water at the drugstore or the supermarket. In Africa, in places like that we're working, northern Uganda, 60% of the population does not have access to a safe water source. They are drinking from the most filthy, vile, disgusting, stagnant pools that you can imagine. It is brown muck, and it is the same place where farm animals and drink from and where mosquitoes breed. And you probably would not drink from this unless you were literally near death, and yet it is the primary drinking source for millions and millions of people around the world, and obviously is a great source of, well, the leading source of childhood mortality and infant mortality and morbidity in Africa.
Now, we have a friend of ours, his name is Keith Snow, and he's a human rights watcher and been involved all around the world, but he calls many of these organizations of aid the misery industry, and says there's tremendous abuses as far as how much money is spent on the salaries and the administration of a lot of these, like USAID and all these other things that are also partly, that are also, a lot of them are cover agencies for the CIA.
And large corporations.
Large corporations,
mm-hmm.
as well, to try to infiltrate these areas and so on. But he said, but what you're saying is, you said basically the amount of waste, I noticed in this write-up, the amount of waste that is spent, money that's spent for...
By the humanitarian organization.
Like you mentioned, there are a big problem with many humanitarian organizations. Some that I know give their aid workers $300 a day, and ridiculous when you're working in places like Africa or Southeast Asia. And he said, and then they provide them a $70,000 Land Cruiser.
Right.
And a $25,000 cruiser would suffice. So there's a tremendous amount of
waste.
Waste.
There's no question that there's a lot of truth in that. I would want to preface that by saying that there are many international organizations, non-governmental organizations that do phenomenal work, and whose relief workers are out there, you know, sometimes laying their lives on the line and working for obviously a lot less money than they might make elsewhere. But then again, there also is this situation of, in my view, substantial waste, almost a kind of institutionalized corruption, in which, for instance, you may see an aid program, an aid agency in a country where, you know, I don't know why, but every time they relocate to a particular location, they all feel like they have to get, you know, a new fleet of land cruisers or whatever. And I don't know, we felt in the areas that we're operating that there's no real need for a new car, so we always buy used ones. And you can buy a perfectly serviceable vehicle for $20,000, $25,000 or less. And so that's what we're doing. With the extra $50,000 that it might cost to buy a Land Cruiser, we could probably drill about 20 or 25 boreholes and provide clean water to about 20,000 or 15,000 people.
Wow.
So that we would think that's a better expenditure of our money.
How many people do you have working in your organization?
Well, we have right now about a half a dozen international staff. We have approximately 20 full-time local staff, and then we have contract and incentive workers who are not, you know, strictly speaking, staff, but people who for whom we provide their only source of livelihood. There's about 20 of those, and then also we provided additional opportunities, business opportunities for women. And we provide these microfinance opportunities as sellers of stoves, because we're also trying, in addition to providing stoves, we're also in refugee and in refugee settings and camps for displaced people. We are trying to also foster a market for these stoves, so that that through the so let's say the genius of the open market, of the free market, we can spread the stove much quicker than we could ever do, than we could ever on our own. We can only make so many stoves. I mean, 50,000 stoves sounds great, but that's not going to solve the deforestation problem or make a huge dent in it in Africa. If we're going to make a dent in it, we have got to get the stove into the market economy so that people buy stoves as a much more important commodity than, say, a cell phone, which is now quite a popular product throughout Africa. And if we can do that, then we can really make a dent. So that's what we're really trying to do. We're trying to stimulate and foster a commercial market for these stoves. So we've engaged a number of women as sort of micro entrepreneurs, vendors of these stoves, and that's been yet another source of employment.
Now, are you seeing people living in huts with no stoves, but yet have a cell phone? Is that happening or no?
Yes, it definitely happens.
It is happening. Oh, God.
Is it normal? No. Most people don't have a cell phone, but the cell phone has become... first of all, it is an extreme... The cell phones are pretty... You get some pretty cheap cell phones in Africa. You could get something for... Well, even as you can here, for $20 or $30. And obviously that allows you a means of communication where, you know, you don't have a decent road, you don't have a car, you don't have any way of getting anywhere quickly. So a phone can be an important tool to have. Most villagers don't have them, but some do. And I would posit that as important as it is, it would cost a lot less money to get a stove, and it'll have a much, much greater impact on a person's life.
How much would a stove cost?
Well, the ones that we're building in Uganda are being sold by our sales force, our female sales force, for about $10 a stove. And that stove will basically save a woman about 600 hours a year in collecting firewood and cooking time. For a person, we also have a charcoal version of the stove. In towns and in the areas around town, people cook with charcoal rather than with firewood. Charcoal is extremely inefficient means of a fuel source, and costs about $15 a month, or $15 to $20 a month for a family. So our stove will reduce the need for that charcoal by about 50%, and so the $10 that they spend on the stove will pay for itself within a month or two.
So do you have any stories about how women have reacted to this stove?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that question.
Do you have any stories about how women have reacted to using this stove? Have they been just delighted with it?
Absolutely delighted. I mean, I've had so many stories about how it has transformed their lives.
Yeah.
Sometimes in quaint ways that I can't even, that I could not have possibly expected. For instance, one woman told us about what she liked about the stove was that it retains its heat. And so if she leaves the water, her water on the stove after she's cooked at night, she can give her baby a warm bath in the morning.
Aww.
I mean, that's just a fringe benefit that, I mean, it really obviously meant a whole lot to her. Imagine never being able to give your baby a warm bath, and now you can do it.
Yeah.
It is obviously impactful for somebody. People all are constantly telling us about how the stove has helped them in terms of the having to collect less wood and that they don't have to breathe in this horrible smoke. One, perhaps the best illustration of how important this stove is to people out there is that one day when we were operating in northern Uganda, and we were frankly experiencing trouble in our program. There were a lot of challenges that we were trying to overcome, and logistically, this is an extremely difficult program, and it requires a lot of time and energy. And we were actually wondering at one point whether, you know, we could do this viably outside the refugee and IDP internal setting. In other words, outside the setting of a refugee camp or a camp for internally people internally displaced by violence. So anyway, what happened was this. This one day, we had sort of turned our operation around, and we had a site where we produced the bricks out of which the stoves are made. We hadn't advertised the existence of this site, but we were all of a sudden, our production had massively improved. And all of a sudden, one day, I got a call from somebody who was out in the field, and he told me that I wouldn't believe it, but 300 women had shown up spontaneously, literally walked from 5 to 10 miles away so they could get the 6 bricks out of which the stove is made. These bricks cost literally about 50 cents to make, so you can imagine somebody walking the entire day to collect these bricks, and they weren't told about it. I mean, we didn't tell them it. They just found out about it somehow by word of mouth, and walk all the way back with the bricks, which are not that light. They're lighter than a normal brick, but we're talking about 25 pounds.
Wow.
And they walk home 6 miles for them, and for the next 2 weeks, women came every day, 100, 200 a day.
Wow.
So I think that tells you how important the stove is to them.
No, they're made they're made out of what, 6 bricks?
They're made out of bricks, but they're not your normal brick. These are special lightweight bricks that are made out of a mixture of clay and burnable organic material. In Uganda, we use rice husk. In Darfur, we used donkey dung. In the Kenyan, on the Somali border of Kenya, we're using cow dung. You can use millet shell. You can use groundnut shells. Pretty much anything that's a small particle that burns. You can use sawdust. Anyway, you mix these two, the clay with this burnable material, and then you fire, you form a brick, and you fire the brick in a kiln. After the kiln gets pretty hot, the burnable material, the organic material will burn away, the rice husk, and that will leave tiny little air pockets in the brick. And those air pockets will trap in the heat. So we take the 6 bricks, we form them together in a circle. Actually, it's 5.5 bricks. A half a brick is used for the entrance of the stove. And you create a combustion chamber that produces a very, very efficient combustion. It essentially operates like a thermos, leaving the heat on the inside and remaining cool on the outside so that it ends up being a safe stove for children.
Now, as far as the exhaust, I mean, is there any exhaust to the...
Well, because the combustion is so efficient, the amount of smoke that is produced is very, very small. And so that is one of the chief benefits of the stove.
What a wonderful idea. Just such a clever idea.
It is clever, and the people who invented it deserve all the credit in the world. They're in Oregon in a research center called Apravecho Research Center. It is a brilliant little innovation.
It really
it's
is.
It's combined with its dimensions, proportions, such as to maximize the heat transfer to the pot, and so you can get a fairly efficient product that's very cheap to make and that is culturally familiar
right.
with the population that you're benefiting. These people are very used to working with clay. And with all the other products that I mentioned, with dung, for instance. And so while there is always a battle to persuade people to change their habits, and I've met some women, particularly some older women, who say to me, I'm never going to use your stove. I'm always going to cook with an open fire. That's what they're used to. They've been cooking that way since the dawn of time.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a big battle, but this stove definitely... reduces that barrier substantially because it is culturally quite suitable.
Oh, that's just a wonderful thing and such a simple, small thing. difference in people's lives.
Huge difference.
It's just amazing.
You can't quantify it. There's so many different. Well, you can actually. In some ways, you can quantify the difference, but it's completely profound, and it's such a small investment, and so.
So doable.
I believe heavily in.
Mm-hmm.
There are problems. It still burns wood,
mm-hmm.
and I would prefer to have a stove that didn't burn any wood, but we're not quite there yet on that stove.
Well,
what other fuel could they possibly burn, really?
There have been some efforts with solar. I'm not a big fan of that because I don't think that culturally it works. I think there are a lot of some obvious barriers. You can't cook with solar when there's no sun.
Right.
You can't cook with solar when it's raining. You can't cook in the morning before the sun has come out. You can't cook in the evening when it's gone down. So, and it's also generally not a very durable stove unless you start paying a lot more money for it beyond the means of people.
What would people do? For instance, if you have, I know you're drilling holes for clean water, but do you have any water purification projects that you're working on, or any new inventions for that?
No. In the places where we're working, there is no more cost-effective way to get water to people than to drill a hole in the ground.
Right.
I mean, literally, the cost comes to $3 a person. So basically, we drill a borehole for $2,500. That will serve a village of 800 people, let's say. That's $3 a person. That water will last for years and years to come. It's the same price that it costs us to go into, to go have lunch somewhere and buy a bottle of water, to go to the supermarket and buy a bottle of water. And that will, quench our thirst for one or two meals. We can provide clean water for the next 3 years, or 3 years, really, 5 to 10 years.
How deep do you have to dig quite a bit deeper on a hole?
It depends on where you are drilling. Now, we've been drilling in areas of northern Uganda where there's a fair amount of waterfall, and the aquifer layer is not too deep below the surface. So we can get safe, clean water, 50, 100 feet below the surface. There are definitely places where we have to drill a lot deeper, and those boreholes are more costly. There are places where you have to drill 200, 300 feet below the surface. But even then, the cost is incredibly cost effective. I mean, then we're talking, instead of $3 a person, we're talking $6 a person,
mm-hmm.
providing water for years and years and years. So there's no filtration system out there that is going to beat that that price.
As far as the maintenance of these things, can the villagers maintain these water?
That is an excellent question, and the answer is not always. I mean, we've certainly experienced situations that are quite disheartening because you're providing a water source. You're training people. You're hoping that people would respect that water source and would maintain it properly, but sometimes that doesn't happen. And you go there and you see that there's no protected a fence, for instance, around the well that you've drilled, which means that that farm animals can gain access to it, for instance. And there are other, and we see other problems. And the solution to that is train, and train some more.
Yeah.
So we establish at every water site a water user committee with people from the village who have the responsibility to properly maintain the site. We set up a system that requires people to pay a small usage fee that goes into a till that's to be used for the maintenance of the site and to make repairs and so forth, minor repairs. And then we also train a village sanitation team, which is then responsible for passing on the information we give them to the rest of the village to make sure that people employ proper hygiene and sanitation practices.
Do you have any other projects that you're thinking of starting like these, or are you just
going? Yeah. Well, there are several. One of the, with respect to the stove project, there are a lot of spin-offs. One thing that happened several years ago is I went to Tanzania, and I learned about a kiln that instead of firing bricks with wood, it fires bricks with rice husk. It was a woodless kiln, and we now use that woodless kiln technology to make our bricks in Uganda. And what we want to do in Uganda and in other countries where there's a large brick-making industry is teach brickmakers how to make bricks with rice husk or other biomass rather than with wood. Now, this makes a much more a much better brick, a more solid brick, a cleaner, a you will lose fewer bricks because the burn is very even, and of course it's an environmentally friendly way of making bricks, which also is a significant source of deforestation. So that is one program that we intend to expand. We also intend to look into the possibility of briquetting, that is using wood substitutes, various forms of biomass that can be burned and can be formed into a brick, a briquette, and be used as a fuel source. It's a challenging project, but it's something that we want to look into.
I wanted to, before we finish tonight, I wanted to mention your event that's happening on Saturday and Thursday.
That's right. For the last 3 years, we became operational in 2006, so I started the foundation earlier. I wasn't sure what we were going to do with it. And for the last 3 years, I have funded the organization almost completely on my own dime, out of the proceeds that I had gotten from the lawsuit. I did not want to ask anyone to put their money into a untested experiment. Although now our operation is beyond my means to sustain indefinitely, and the experiment is no longer untested. It's verified. This works. And so we are having our first major fundraising event on Thursday here in Washington, D.C. We'll be having a cultural dance and an art exhibit and a classical singer.
Now, that's invitation only, that particular one.
That one is invitation only, though.
But this Saturday.
We've extended a lot of invitations. The second event is on Saturday.
Yeah.
It is also includes the art exhibit, and it will be a benefit concert that is sponsored by a very popular musical band here, the Thievery Corporation, and the music will be from a German band that is called Ancient Astronauts. So it should be a very fun event. It'll be an opportunity for people to learn about Lifeline and support operations.
I was just looking at, the one on Thursday, which is different. That's got the African heritage dancers and drummers. But the one on Saturday, that is, again, a 100 artists art exhibit, and the photography by Deborah Terry.
That's right. Deborah is my partner, and she is the creative genius behind the International Lifeline Fund.
Oh, okay.
And she goes to Africa and taking some wonderful pictures of some of the nomadic movements in Darfur and of village life and refugee life.
And your artists, you've drawn from around the world, over 400 artists, and that Art Wino is a D.C.-based art gallery. So they're supplying all the artwork, I guess. And if you want to... if people want to donate, or if people are headed down to Washington this weekend for some reason, and they'd like to go to it, can you tell them where it is and what?
Absolutely. Our website is www.lifelinefund.org. So if people want to donate, they can just go on to the website. That's LIFELINE fund, FUND.org. And if people want to come to Washington, D.C. to the event, on Saturday, or even if they want to come to the event on Thursday and they want to give me an email through the website, you can get my email address, but it's dwolf@lifelinefund.org. We still have room for people.
Lifeline.
But on the event is right near the Mandarin Oriental Hotel in Southwest Washington, D.C. So if you look up the Mandarin Oriental, we're at 1234 Maryland Avenue. We're just right adjacent to it, and you'll definitely see it if you show up between 6 o'clock and midnight on the Saturday. Or on the 24th between 7 and 11 o'clock.
Well, we wish you the best of success with your fundraiser and with all your endeavors. It sounds like you're off to such a wonderful start and such clever, innovative ideas that are so doable for the people that you're trying to help.
Yeah. Well, that's the objective, and I really thank you both for allowing me to giving this opportunity to participate on your show and tell people about Lifeline and what it's all about.
Well, thank you for being with us. It's always great to have people like you, Dan.
And again, that's lifelinefund.org.
That's right.
Is that correct? Lifelinefund.org.
Okay.
So thank you so much, Dan, and we wish you the best.
Good night.
Good night.
And that was
Dan Wolf talking to us about what he's doing in Africa and about his fundraiser. You can go to www.lifelinefund.org.
Yeah.
All right, and that ends that interview. But we wanted to, before we end tonight, we still got about 3 or 4 minutes. I wanted to just read a little bit more about Dan and what he's accomplished. And he's a relentless optimist. 48, he's a true pioneer who fuses his fierce lawyerly skills with social justice, keen environmentalism, and phenomenal philanthropy. Perhaps more than anyone, Wolf is a master of turning crisis into opportunity. His commitment to ending the atrocities for African refugees, displaced persons, and impoverished villagers is not a lawyerly role or a performance. It's real and it is serious. He describes the current dangers to much of the African continent as diminishing natural resources, and claims that if escalating resource problems are not resolved, violence similar to that in Darfur will spread throughout Africa, with cataclysmic results for Africans and the entire world. Wolf could have used his newfound wealth, gained from the horrors of Saddam Hussein's actions, to live a rich and pampered life, but instead chose to serve and vanquish the vulnerable. Wolf's philanthropic story unfolds in Iraq in 1990. It was during the first Gulf War that brought American military presence to the Middle East. Iraq had just invaded neighboring Kuwait, and hundreds of U.S. citizens working and living in that region had been taken hostage by Saddam Hussein. Many of these hostages were made into human shields by the Iraqi regime, which forcibly relocated them into vulnerable to bombing facilities and a strategic attempt to prevent the U.S. bombing of those locations. They were also subject to cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment, some brutally tortured in violation of the Geneva Convention. And U.S. government strategically submerged the issue, and the media lamely followed suit. And following the crisis, Wolf conceived of and drafted a bill that essentially permitted victims of terrorism to sue rogue states that committed such abuses. Congress passed that legislation in 1996, and 3 years later, Wolf initiated a lawsuit, Hills versus Republic of Iraq, on behalf of 180 of the victims of Iraq's human shield policy. For 2 years, the case lay dormant. Then soon after the World Trade Center's attack, the case moved rapidly through the courts, which granted awards totaling $95 million to Wolf's 180 clients. However, the Bush administration, through the U.S. State Department, fought against having these judgments paid, and Wolf had to go back to Congress, where he succeeded in pushing through legislation and authorized American victims of terrorism to collect their judgments against terrorist states. With another war on the Saddam regime fast approaching, Wolf then found himself in a race against time, knowing that if he did not collect the assets before that time, the Bush administration would requisition the monies to fund the war and subsequent recovery effort. Fortunately, Wolf and his team were able to obtain liens against the U.S. banks holding the Iraqi assets, and on the eve of the war, the government finally relented and released the funds. And once the Iraqi assets were collected and distributed to the hostages, Wolf made a life-transforming decision. In honor of his father and in fulfillment of a personal commitment he made to himself, Wolf used a substantial portion of his share of the fee to create a lifeline and a gift-giving foundation, the George Wolf Memorial Trust. And from the outset, Wolf's objective was to establish a different kind of international relief organization, one that would strive to make every dollar count in order to have the greatest impact in receiving and suffering of the suffering of refugees and the internally displaced and other vulnerable persons in the poorest regions of the world. His programs operate with maximum flexibility and efficiency, and there is absolutely no bureaucratic waste because they are strategically designed to give needy individuals the tools and knowledge they require to lift themselves out of poverty so they can become more productive members of society. And imagine you are with Wolf on his first trip to Africa. and so on and so forth. And it's great. It's a great line. Check it out at lifelinefund.org. And I want to thank everybody for joining me tonight. Join me tomorrow night when we go into the spiritual world, and we'll be entertaining you there. So have a pleasant evening, and good night.